good morning. It's good to see everybody out this morning. We're going to continue these lessons here in Isaiah this morning. I'm sure everyone out here has probably been in a cave at one time or another. I read of a tour in the Mammoth Cave region in Kentucky where a guide stopped and addressed the crowd and asked, do you all want to see what a real cave looks like? And thinking that they were going to get to go on a different part of the cave than usually was seen, they all raised their hands and eagerly agreed. And so without another word, the guide reached over and shut off the lights. And he said, this is what a real cave looks like. Well, caves can be scary places, especially if you have no light. I'm told in moments of total darkness, a lot of people get pretty edgy. In fact, if the light remains off for any length of time, some people will even begin to panic. Most of us don't like sitting around in darkness. One preacher noted that we learn from an early age to fear darkness. That's why night lights are so popular with little children. That little 4-watt bulb is able to chase away some of the darkness and bring a little bit of measure of comfort to a little one that's there in the dark. And even as we continue to grow up, there is still this inborn fear of the dark. If you hear a strange noise in your house while it's in the middle of the afternoon, you might think, well, that's a little bit odd, but sometimes you don't give a second thought about that. But if you hear that same strange noise in the total darkness at around 3 a.m., your wife, or in my case, I would start nudging Missy and say, you need to go see what's making that noise. Darkness is uncomfortable. Darkness can be confusing. And at times, darkness can be terrifying. And here in Isaiah chapter 9, God talks about people sitting around in darkness. And again, these people are uncomfortable. They are more than just a little bit confused. They are seriously afraid for their future. And last week we looked at a prophecy from Isaiah chapter 7. And there Isaiah promised that a virgin would conceive and give birth to a son. And if you were here last week, you'll remember that there are many who don't believe in that virgin birth, even amongst preachers and theologians that refuse to believe God could do or would do any such thing. They believe in a God that doesn't have any real power or a desire to intercede in the lives of men. And some of them not only reject that idea of the virgin birth, but they even reject the idea that this prophecy has anything to do with Jesus. But the Jews had long considered this section of Isaiah to be messianic. More than 500 years before Jesus was born in Bethlehem, the Jews returned to Judea from their longtime captivity in Babylon. And around that time, the Jewish religious leaders began to write commentaries on the various books of the Bible at that time. And they called these writings the Tangrams. And one of those Tangrams dealt with this prophecy of Isaiah. And on that Tangram, which again was written about 500 years before Christ was born, this was the commentary they wrote on Isaiah 9 verse 6. And there was called his name from of old, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, He who lives forever, the Messiah, in whose days shall increase upon us. So again, for over 500 years, the Jewish people knew that this section of Isaiah spoke about the coming Christ. And thus, in Isaiah chapter 7, we're told that Israel's told that that coming Messiah would be born of a virgin. And now here, two chapters later, Isaiah continues on with that prophecy. And he tells them where this child of that virgin would be born, where he would be ministering. He tells the things that that child born of a virgin, that what he would accomplish. But first, Isaiah tells Israel where this child would minister. It says, but there will be no gloom for her who is in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in later time, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. And you'll notice Isaiah mentions here the land of Zebulun and Naphtali. Years before this prophecy, shortly after the death of King Solomon, 10 of the tribes of Israel rebelled against the king, and they split off to form a new nation that was called Israel in the north, while two remaining tribes in the south became known as the land of Judah. Zebulun and Naphtali were two of those 10 tribes in the northern nation of Israel. But they were relatively insignificant tribes. They were rarely mentioned anywhere in the Old Testament, and they were never spoken of having anything important being done. That is until God mentions them here in Isaiah chapter 9. And again, you'll remember, these are the only tribes in northern Israel that God included in connection with the coming Messiah. And one has to wonder why that would be. And I think we'd have to think about where Jesus lived just for a minute. We know that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, which is south of Jerusalem in the land of Judah. But when Herod learned of the prophecy of a king being born in Bethlehem, he became not so happy. And he saw this new king as a threat to his own throne, and he sought out to kill him. But warned in a dream, Joseph and Mary fled with their child to the land of Egypt, where they remained there until King Herod died. And with that threat finally removed, Jesus and his family returned to their home. But not to that home in Bethlehem. They returned to the home that they had left years before. They returned to Nazareth, and Nazareth was in the region of Galilee. And you could probably guess where I'm going to tell you what tribes inherited or inhabited that land of Galilee. It would be Zebulun and Naphtali. And Matthew tells us that early in Christ's ministry, that Jesus left his home in Nazareth, and it tells us there that he went and lived in Capernaum by the sea in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people dwelling in darkness have seen a great light. And for those dwelling in the region and shadow of death, on them a light has dawned. And that's interesting. Galilee was once the area once inhabited by Zebulun and Naphtali. When Jesus began his ministry, he resided there in Capernaum in Galilee. And it was in Galilee that Jesus performed his first miracle. It was also in Galilee where Jesus selected most of his 12 apostles. And it was in Galilee that he spent most of his time preaching and teaching and performing various miracles and healings. Jesus literally brought the light of his ministry to the people who lived in the land that had once been Zebulun and Naphtali. And so Isaiah told us where the child born of a virgin would minister. But Isaiah didn't stop there. He went on to say what the child born of a virgin would do. If you'll look again there in verses 2 and 3 of Isaiah 9, it says that the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of deep darkness, on them light has shone. You have multiplied the nation, you have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. In the days of Jesus, Galilee, that land of Zebulun and Naphtali, was considered a very dark land. It was a backwater region where mostly the poor and uneducated lived. It wasn't a very enlightened area. And when Peter and John, later in Acts chapter 4, would speak before the Sanhedrin, they amazed the leaders of Judah because they were obviously Galilean. They were unschooled. They were ordinary men. And yet they spoke with such courage and power. Galilee's reputation was such that when Philip told Nathanael that he had found the Messiah, Nathanael exclaimed, "Could anything good come out of Nazareth?" It wasn't thought of very high. But Jesus lived in this obscure part of Israel on purpose. He lived there so he could drive home that his life was meant to shine a very powerful and hope-filled light into a very dark world. During his ministry, Jesus said that I have come to bring into the world as a light, so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness. Again, he says that I am the light of this world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. What was this light meant to change in our lives? Well, Isaiah 9 verse 2 tells us that the people walked in darkness have seen a great light. They have dwelled in the shadow of death. Upon them the light has shined. They lived in this valley or the land of the shadow of death. And death can be a very dark and scary prospect. But Jesus came into the world to shine the light of his hope into a world that was afraid of the darkness of death. The writer of Hebrews tells us in Hebrews, the second chapter, in verses 14 and 15, that since for the children share in the flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is, the devil, and deliver all those who, through fear of death, were subject to lifelong slavery. Well, years ago, a Christmas card company put out a Christmas card with the title, What If Christ Did Not Come? And it was based on that verse in John chapter 15, verse 22, where Christ makes that statement, if I had not come. And inside of that card, they told of a story of a preacher who had fallen asleep and dreamt of a world without Jesus. In his dream, he finds himself alone at home looking through his house. It is Christmas Day, but there are no stockings hung by the chimney, no bells ringing in the church steeple. There are no wreaths, there are no holly. There are no churches, no books in his library about Jesus. And suddenly he hears a knock on his door. A young man has come to the preacher's house to tell him that his mother is dying. And he would ask that the preacher would come and speak some words of comfort for her. And so the preacher picks up his Bible. But when he opened his Bible to find some comforting scriptures, he found that the Bible ended with Malachi. There were no gospels. There was no hope, no promises. All he could do was bow his head and weep. 2 days later at her funeral, he had no words of comfort, no hope, because there was no consolation or hope of heaven. Without Jesus to light, there was no light to push back the darkness of death. The grave remains the final door for which there is no returning, because no one had ever come back from the dead. And so if Jesus wasn't who he said he was, that's how it would be. But we know, as 1 Corinthians 15:20 tells us, that Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. So Jesus sheds a powerful light on the fear of the blackness of death. And for us as Christians, there is no longer any reason to fear. His light has broken down the door of death and freed us from its terrors. But his light means much more than just victory over the darkness of the grave. It also means that Jesus will light up the very life that we live right now. And Jesus explained this to his disciples. In John chapter 15, verse 11, Jesus tells them, "These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full." There's something about Jesus being inside of us that creates a pool of joy and hope and peace that nothing can take away. Paul talks about it as being the peace that passes all understanding. It's something that you can't hardly even explain, but it's there. It's maybe like the joy you feel on a bright, sunshiny summer day. The birds are singing, the air is fresh, maybe a cool breeze hits your face, and you just feel good. You can't really explain why you feel good. It's just something that you do. And that's how it is for those of us that have Christ in our lives. A few years ago, a lady by the name of Diana Tierney told of a feeling that she had missed out on because she didn't believe. And she wrote these words. She said, "Over the years, I've come to think I'm missing out. My friends and relatives who rely on God, the real believers, not just those who attend church, have an expansiveness of the Spirit. When they walk along a stream, they don't just see falling water over rocks. The sights fill them with ecstasy. They see a realm of hope that is beyond this world. I just see a babbling brook. I didn't get the message." Well, Isaiah chapter 9, verse 3 says that what is promised with the coming Messiah. When he is coming with his coming, he enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as men rejoice as they divide the spoil. Their joy is like people who know that there will be a harvest. They are assured that there will be food on their table because there is food in the pantry. They know that their needs are going to be taken care of. They know that there is someone there that is going to take care of them and back them up. The light from Jesus is a little like walking into a room that you've never been in before. If you walk into that room when the lights are on, you might be a little anxious and uneasy. You don't know where the obstacles are, how the furniture is arrayed, but if you can see it, that's fine. But if the light is not on, you aren't able to see those things, and you don't know where all those obstacles are, and you would run into them. Well, that's the difference that Jesus brings to our lives. We no longer have to walk in the darkness with unease and anxiety. When we walk with his light. And our lives, by that, are completely different. The famed Austrian psychologist Carl Jung once wrote about a life without God. And he said those psychiatrists who are not superficial have come to the conclusion that the vast neurotic misery of the world can be termed a neurosis of the emptiness. Men cut themselves off from the root of their being, from God, and then life turns empty, inane, meaningless, without purpose. And so that thinking would say when God goes, goals go. And when goals go, then meaning goes. And when meaning goes, value goes, and life turns dead on our hands. With the light of God that's promised here in Isaiah, that all has changed. But how did God give us that light? How did God intend to give our lives power and hope and peace and joy? Well, I think we read that verse in Isaiah 9:6. For to us a child was born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be on his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. God stepped into a world that was very dark and empty. He came down in human form and allowed himself to be put to death for our sins. Again, as Isaiah prophesied, the Messiah would be called Emmanuel, God with us. God could simply have given us an instruction book and walked away. And he did. He gave us the Bible. He gave us the very best instruction manual mankind has ever possessed. But really, without God being with us, the Bible would just be a dry set of do's and don'ts, filled with wise advice and interesting stories. But our lives would lack that ultimate element that could change our lives and give us the light that we need in a very dark world. Paul Harvey once told a story of a man who was very kind and decent, and mostly a good man. He was generous to his family, and he was upright with his dealings with others. But he did not believe in all of the incarnation stuff about Jesus and Christmas. It didn't make sense to him, and he was too honest to really pretend otherwise. He could just not swallow the idea that Jesus was God coming to earth as a man. And he said, "I'm truly sorry to dismiss or distress you," is what he told his wife, "but I'm not going to church this Christmas." He said that he would feel like a hypocrite, that he'd much rather stay home, but that he would stay and wait up for them. And so he stayed, and they went. And shortly after the family drove away in the car, snow began to fall. And he went to the window to watch the flurries getting heavier and heavier. And then he went back to sit in his chair by the fireside and began to read the newspaper. And minutes later, he was startled by a thudding sound, and then another, and then another. At first, he thought it was someone throwing snowballs against his living room window. But when he went to the front door, he found a flock of birds huddled miserably there in the snow. They had been caught in the storm, and in a desperate search for shelter, they tried to get through his large landscape window. He didn't want to let the poor creatures lie there and freeze. And he remembered that the barn where his children stabled their pony, there he could provide them warm shelter. Again, if he could just direct the birds to it. And quickly he put on his coat and galoshes and he trampled out into the deepening snow to the barn where he opened the door wide and turned on the light. But the birds refused to come. He figured he would put out some food and that would entice them, and he hurried back into his house and he fetched some breadcrumbs and he sprinkled them on the ground leading up to the barn. But again, the birds did nothing. They just ignored it and they continued to flap helplessly in the snow. He tried catching them, he tried shooing them into the barn by walking around and waving his arms above his head, but instead he just scattered them in every direction except towards the warm barn. He realized that the birds were afraid of him. To them, he finally reasoned, I am a strange and a terrifying creature. If only I could think some way to let them know that they could trust me, that I'm not going to hurt them, that I'm here to help them. And he couldn't think of a reason how. Any move he made tended to make the birds more frightened and confuse them. They wouldn't follow him. They would not be led. Again, they would not be shooed because they feared him. And he thought, if only I could be a bird myself. If only I could be a bird and mingle with them and speak their language and tell them not to be afraid and show them the way to the safe, warm barn. But then I would have to be one of them so they could hear me and understand me. And then the story goes that at that moment the church bells began to ring. The sound reached his ears above the sound of the wind, and he stood there listening to the bells. Listening, he heard the bells pealing the glad tidings of Christmas. And there he sank to his knees in the snow. Finally understanding that God had done exactly what he wanted to do for the birds, that God had done for mankind. This morning, if you are not a Christian, we encourage you to make that decision. This morning, if you are a Christian, but you found something lacking in that walk, again, now would be the time to make those needs known as together we stand and we sing. Thank you.